When the Civil War began, men from all over our young nation went to war. More than 600,000 of those men would never return home. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. More than half the men who died in the Civil War died of disease rather than injuries sustained on the battlefield. Just as our nation was young, so was the practice of medicine. Today, I'll talk with Dr. Kendall Reed of Des Moines University about the work of doctors during the Civil War and how the war forever changed the practice of medicine. Later in the hour, Lester Menke will share his memories of growing up in the 20s and 30s. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. More than 600,000 men died during the Civil War. Twice as many men died of disease rather than gunshot wounds. With so many sick and wounded, the need for doctors was great, but the doctors of the time lacked the tools and knowledge to treat most of what was wrong with their patients. My guest today is Dr. Kendall Reed. He is Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Des Moines University and a history buff. He'll be speaking at the State Historical Society of Iowa on Saturday about medicine in the Civil War. Hello, Dr. Reed.
Well, good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to do it.
When the call went out for soldiers during the Civil War, did a call also go out for doctors?
You know, at the time, there really wasn't. Mostly it was for troops. At the time that the Civil War began, the Union forces were actually covered by less than 100 doctors. The Confederate forces, physicians were kind of put together at the last minute, obviously, and consisted probably at the time that the Civil War actually began less than 25 doctors to take care of literally hundreds of thousands of men that were going to ultimately engage. So not a specific call for doctors. And back in those days, the medical corps of the federal troops had not really experienced anything like they were going to experience in the Civil War. There had been some Indian wars, obviously, but the medical corps, as we know it today, was really started when the Civil War began in 1861.
How were doctors trained at that time?
It was very much a preceptorship. Back in those days, in the mid-1800s, medical school curriculum was very erratic, and the formal training of physicians was more of a preceptorship. And they had a certain amount of classwork, but it was really quite minimal. And interestingly enough, there were literally hundreds of medical schools from about 1850 to the early 1900s at the time of the Flexner Report that were in existence. Most of those medical schools were kind of in a for-profit mode, and actually the training that these doctors got was simply by tagging along with other doctors. There was certainly no such thing as formal training in residency programs like we now have in this country following the completion of medical schools. And certainly none of these physicians had much experience in trauma surgery, which they were about to experience during the time of the Civil War.
As the battles began to commence, and I'm sure that they discovered very quickly that there was a tremendous need for doctors. How were the doctors even organized with so few?
Well, the first experience that really opened the eyes of physicians on both sides was the first Battle of Bull Run, which was fought very early in the first few months of the Civil War just outside of Washington, D.C. And that was more or less of a battle that was essentially planned because both forces knew that they were going to meet. They didn't know exactly where they were going to meet in this small town outside of Washington, D.C., where the Battle of Bull Run was ultimately fought. But it almost, that battle was so planned that it was almost a social event, and a lot of the a lot of people actually traveled from Washington, D.C., the day before or the morning of that battle to actually watch the battle unfold. And during that battle, the Union forces actually marched all night in their brand new uniforms and their brand new boots to get to the point where they could engage the rebels. The rebels had been there a little bit before, and they were a little better prepared, a little better rested. But as the battle unfolded in those morning hours of July of 1861, it became quite obvious that the rebel forces were going to win that battle. And after a few hours and the deaths of several hundred men, as well as the injury of several hundred men, the Union forces were essentially routed and sent scurrying back to Washington, D.C. What they did not count on was how are they going to take care of these men that are laying on this battlefield. And they were very ill-prepared on both sides. Stonewall Jackson was leading the rebel forces at this time, and actually he got his name at the Battle of Bull Run because he sat up on his horse observing this massive unleashing of fury and stood essentially on his horse, and one of his soldiers commented, look at Jackson, he looks like a stone wall sitting there. And he watched as his men, as well as the Union forces, were actually injured and killed in and approximately 3,000 men in that battle lost their lives or were injured. So as the Union forces began to essentially scurry back to Washington, D.C., by wagon, by foot, by horseback, any way they could get back, many could not make it. And so they actually took care of these men in farmhouses, in barns, and any kind of shelter that they could find on the way, on the 20 miles back to Washington, D.C. And as you can imagine, it was fought about this time of the year in Washington, D.C., with temperatures very similar to what we're dealing with right now in our state, very hot.
Terrible swamp then.
Oh, it was. And so these soldiers were literally, some made it back to D.C., to the hospitals that were in Washington. Many did not. Many died on the way back. Many laid in the field for several hours or even a day or two before they were actually able to be transported. And so at that point in the war, the medical corps realized that they were totally ill-prepared to deal with the injuries and the magnitude of the injuries that were going to occur not only in that battle but in future battles. So very ill-prepared on both sides.
What actions were taken then to remedy that in the future?
Well, at the time that the Civil War started, the Surgeon General for the Union forces was an elderly man that had been a career Army officer who had himself really never been engaged in any significant type of trauma experience of certainly of the magnitude that they saw. So he was quite ill-prepared to deal with this, and he was basically asked to step down by Lincoln. And Lincoln appointed a young lieutenant, actually, by the name of William Hammond, to be the Surgeon General. And William Hammond was a physician that he himself had little experience in trauma surgery, but he was quite innovative, and he saw the problems that were going to need to be solved. And Hammond was actually promoted from status of a lieutenant to a brigadier general in one fell swoop by Lincoln, which to many of the career military men that had been sitting in line waiting for the current Surgeon General to step down, it irritated them. So Hammond kind of got handed that job at a very difficult time in medicine. So he was kind of up against some of his own politics, but yet actually started the process to develop leadership that would develop an ambulance system, particularly to specifically address how these men would be transported on and off the field. How would you prepare for battles ahead of time rather than waiting until something happened and then trying to rush out and rush around and get these men off the battlefield.
With so few doctors, I would guess that a lot of the medicine and treatment had to be administered by people with no medical training at all.
Yeah, they did have our equivalent of what's used to be called corpsmen, are now medics in the military, and those corpsmen had very, very little experience, and quite honestly, they had very little supplies that were actually useful, certainly as we would know them today. They really had very little to care for these soldiers. Most of the wounds early in the Civil War were the result of musket fire. Very few actually were the result of either a saber or a cannon or the larger artillery. Most of it was musket fire, and the corpsmen really didn't know what to do with these soldiers other than to get them off the battlefield. Unlike the corpsmen and the medics that we have today, who are outstandingly trained and save lives every day with the degree of sophistication they have, these were basically aides and had little to offer these soldiers other than to get them out of harm's way.
Well, and even getting them out of harm's way, I know that rations were notoriously short during great portions of the Civil War. There were probably periods where it was almost impossible to find clean water, so they didn't even have the basic tools that they needed to take care of them.
That is absolutely correct, and particularly on the Confederate side, the Union forces blockaded all the ports on the East Coast that would have any access to supply the Confederacy. So that blockade was very effective. And so consequently, the soldiers in the Confederacy suffered considerably more than those soldiers on the Union side. Early in the war, it was apparent that because of the shortage of doctors that there was, that you could not take doctors as prisoners of war. That was done early in the war, and both sides suddenly realized, wait a minute, we don't have enough doctors to take care of these soldiers. Why don't we come to a common agreement that physicians would not be taken as POWs? And so within the first few months of the war, that was decided on both sides. And there are many, many instances in the battles that ensued later in the Civil War where a Union doctor would be taking care of a Confederate soldier in their hospital or vice versa. So there was a fair amount of compassion among the men, but clearly not enough doctors to take care of the massive number of wounds that occurred in that war.
My guest is Dr. Kendall Reed. He is Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Des Moines University and a Civil War history buff. We're talking today about medicine in the Civil War. He'll be speaking at the State Historical Society of Iowa on Saturday at 2 p.m. on the same subject. Later this hour, we're going to talk about some more recent memory. I'll talk with Lester Menke about growing up during the 1920s and 30s. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later in the hour, I'm going to be talking with Lester Menke. He shares his memories of growing up during the 1920s and 30s in his new book, When Apples Had No Worms. But right now, we're going a little deeper into history. We're talking about medicine during the Civil War. And my guest is Dr. Kendall Reed. He is Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Des Moines University. He'll be speaking on Saturday at 2 o'clock at the State Historical Society of Iowa. And you're welcome to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100, tweet us at IPR Talk, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Dr. Reed, I mentioned earlier that disease was really even a much graver danger for these soldiers than the fact that they were fighting in a war. There's graver danger than the gunshot wounds, the musket wounds that they received. What were the diseases that caused so much trouble?
You know, Charity, the diseases were all usually of the communicable type or related just to poor sanitation and poor water. Malaria was a big killer. The dysenteric diseases were big killers. Even measles. Most of these soldiers came from a rural setting and had not been exposed to the childhood diseases. And when you put 300 or 400 men together in a camp that's small, poorly aerated, poor sanitation, poor water, and if one gets the measles, they all get the measles. So obviously there was no such thing as immunization back in those days, and so one of the quotes back in the Civil War is, if you want to stop an enemy, give them a disease of some sort. The dysenteric diseases that they dealt with due to the common organisms that are out in the fields and the pastures were devastating, and again, no treatment available for these. They had to kind of run a natural course, and unfortunately, those diseases killed two-thirds of the men that died in the Civil War. Of the 600-plus thousand that you mentioned, well over 400,000 of them died in their camps or their prison or in prison camps, which again were poorly. They had very poor housing. They had poor sanitation. They had no food, and so some of these men, the pictures that we have available from Matthew Brady and his photographers, document just a very distressing pattern that these men went through, and died. A very horrible death, much more horrible sometimes than the gunshot wounds.
The Union Army reported that the quote is, more than 995 out of every 1,000 men eventually contracted chronic diarrhea or dysentery.
Yeah, that is true. Everybody got sick. It's just a matter of how sick you were. And there was a sick call every day for the soldiers, and the soldiers would simply line up before the physicians and the medics and try to get through sick call. And again, because they had such limited medications, there were some very rudimentary medications that were used to control the dysenteric diseases. But they're, in and of themselves, they were almost as toxic sometimes as the diseases. So they had a lot of side effects from these medications, unfortunately.
Well, and certainly I know they were still using mercury at the time, right?
They were. They were using mercury, and they were using calomel. They had opium derivatives that they could give. They had quinine that was somewhat effective against malaria. But again, most of those medications were in short supply, and particularly on the Confederate side, their men really did not have the availability of those medicines unless they were close to a major city. If some of these battles that were fought out in the Western Front were very poorly supplied. The supply lines were just simply not there.
I think one of the images that many of us think of when we think about Civil War medicine are men who've been injured and have to have a limb amputated.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that did happen a lot. I've been talking mostly about the disease so far just because it was so much more prevalent. But how much amputation was going on in these camps?
When the Civil War started, and because our experiences in American medicine were so limited at that time, at the first part of the Civil War, it was kind of an unwritten rule that if you had an injury to an extremity, arm or leg, and it fractured a bone with that gunshot wound, that it automatically meant an amputation. Whether or not the blood supply to that extremity was compromised or not. And it was felt that because the combination of the soft tissue injury and the bone fracture and all of the debris and dirt that were brought into that wound, that the majority of these soldiers would get some type of infectious process which would lead to gangrene, and therefore most surgeons on both sides recommended amputation as the treatment of choice for those gunshot wounds, and particularly those that that broke a bone. As the war progressed, there was some change in philosophy of that, and many, many extremities were salvaged towards the end of the war. But it would not be unusual after a major battle for a team of Civil War surgeons to literally do 50 to 100 amputations a day. And there are, again, Matthew Brady photographs of tents where the surgeons were operating that literally extremities were put on a pile outside of the tent and then hauled off at the end of the day and disposed of. So it's a fairly distressing photograph, obviously, to look at, but clearly lives were saved. I think probably the one of the more famous amputations of the war, if you want to call it that, was that of Stonewall Jackson, who was at the time that he was injured in 1863 at the Battle of Chancellorsville. The rebel forces had actually won that battle, and Stonewall Jackson and his cadre of leadership at the end of the day decided to take a little trip out into the battlefield and look around and see kind of the results of the day. And so it was near dusk, and he and his men rode out and were coming back to camp, and he and his aides were mistaken for Union forces, and so Stonewall was actually shot by his own men. He was shot three times, in fact. He was shot twice in the right arm and once in the left arm, and obviously knocked him off his horse. And once they had realized that they had shot their own general, everybody rushed out to get him, and they put him on a stretcher and were taking him back to the field hospital. And because of all the commotion of the gunfire, essentially the battle kind of re-engaged at that point. And as his medics were trying to get him off the battlefield in a stretcher, they actually dropped him on the ground. And in retrospect, most people think he probably was injured and suffered a chest injury by falling on a large rock there. They got him back to his camp, and his private physician by the name of McGuire actually traveled with Stonewall Jackson with all of his campaigns. And so Hunter McGuire actually saw Stonewall and realized that the injury in his right arm were soft tissue injuries, but the injury in his left arm had fractured his humerus, which is the larger bone in the upper arm. And so Hunter McGuire recommended to Stonewall that they proceed with an amputation immediately. And they did that, and he actually did very, very well with that. Robert E. Lee, who was several miles away, who was the commanding general of all the rebel forces, could not be there and could not get to Stonewall in time, but sent a note by a courier that that was very poignant, in saying, "You may have lost your left arm, but I've lost my right hand," and meaning that the leadership that Stonewall Jackson had given the rebel forces would no longer be seen. And actually, Jackson rallied a little bit for a few days, but within about 7 days developed pneumonia, probably as a result of the injury that he sustained when he was dropped by the corpsman, and he got pneumonia. And even though his amputation site was healing well, he ultimately died of pneumonia about 7 to 10 days after that injury. And so that was really a defining point in the Civil War from the standpoint of the rebel cause, because the Battle of Gettysburg was fought within the next 45 days, and as you know, that battle was the turning point. And the rebel forces really never recovered after the loss of Stonewall Jackson.
With all of these amputations taking place, what kind of anesthesia did the doctors have access to?
Yeah, it's a great myth today that there was no such thing as anesthesia in the Civil War, and that is absolutely not true. Anesthesia had been discovered in Boston in 1847, although it was used, and it was successfully used at that time. But in the ensuing years up to the Civil War, very few operations had been done under anesthesia in Boston. And again, they didn't have the trauma that we're talking about. But in the Civil War, chloroform and ether, and even occasionally nitrous oxide, which is a gas, were available to both sides, and more so available to the Union side, but it was used very successfully. And the myth that Civil War soldiers had to, you know, suffer without anesthesia is absolutely not true. It was used very successfully and very safely, and essentially the birth of anesthesia for elective operations and for even traumatic operations actually grew out of our knowledge learned from the Civil War.
Was it widely available, or were there battlefields where it just didn't make it there?
You know, it was, I won't say it was widely available on the battlefield. It was out there, and much more so on the Union side because they had much better supply lines. But certainly in all of the hospitals, both in Richmond, and which was the Confederate hospitals, and in Washington, D.C., which had several hospitals, it was very much available there. It sure was.
Another thing that we see often dramatized in Civil War movies, of course, we see the dreaded bone saw. What kind of tools did the doctors have to perform these surgeries?
On the Union side, the senior surgeons received a kit, an operating kit, which consisted of, like you say, a bone saw, several different types of knives for performing the soft tissue amputation. There were instruments called rongeurs, which were used to kind of bite off pieces of bone as needed. There was a suture material. There were trephines, which are a circular saw that actually could be used to drill out bony pieces of the skull for men that received head injuries to relieve pressure and bleeding. Obviously, those neurosurgical procedures were very fraught with a lot of danger, but not too many men lived after the neurosurgical. But those kits were issued to the Union surgeons, but very limited in supply. And the Confederacy tried to kind of, by hook or crook, find those instruments. And there are a few Confederate sets around, but extremely rare to find those. In fact, extremely rare to find the Union kits anymore. Most of them are now housed in museums around the country, and they're really fascinating. And they range in size from having 10 or 15 instruments to having 30 or 40 instruments. Most of those instruments were made in Europe, a few made in a company in New York called Tiemann Brothers, and again, very, very difficult to find today, but fascinating to look at.
We've talked about how anesthesia was something relatively new at the beginning of the Civil War, and that really revolutionized how surgery was done after the war. What else changed? The Civil War medicine has been cited as really being the birth of modern medicine in our country. What is the legacy?
You know, I think the legacy, certainly anesthesia is one thing. The second thing, the transportation of men off of the battlefield, that lesson was learned early on, and so some dramatic changes were made. The ambulance system that we use today, if you go inside of any EMS vehicle, it's very structured. Supplies are put in an appropriate place so that everybody knows where the supplies. And so they actually started that process in the Civil War where they didn't have vehicles. They had supply wagons, but the supply wagons were actually organized to where anybody could come up and they know where the suture is, they know where the gauze is, they know where the medications are. And so that was hugely a big thing. They learned early on that rapid transport of men off a battlefield, obviously. And today, in our American military, you know, the so-called golden hour that we talk about of getting a soldier off of a battlefield, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan, that golden hour is absolutely precious. And if they can be evacuated to a back site quickly, their chances of survival today are much better than they ever were, even in the Vietnam War. So we've learned a lot of lessons that way. So proper preparation, proper planning, training of surgeons today that specifically address battlefield injuries, and doing trauma today in American medicine in an emergency room in a community like Des Moines, for instance, that's much different than what these physicians were dealing with. The extent of the trauma was significantly greater back in those days, just because of the guns that they used, the artillery that they used. So it's hard for us to look back and understand the magnitude of what these physicians faced. At the end of a day, when they look out on a battlefield and there's 3,000 or 4,000 men laying there in varying degrees of injury and pain, we don't see that. I mean, we don't see that amount of trauma in a town like Des Moines in a year, and they would see it in one day, literally. And so I think we sometimes criticize people, but if we're not there to know what they were dealing with, we should be very careful when we do that.
Well, we're out of time, but I'd love for you to come back. We haven't even talked about nursing during the Civil War, which also
great advances in nursing
revolutionized.
Absolutely.
Dr. Kendall Reed, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Glad to do it. Thanks, Charity.
Dr. Kendall Reed is Dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Des Moines University. He will be speaking at the State Historical Society of Iowa on Saturday at 2 p.m. about medicine in the Civil War. The State Historical Society is hosting a speaker series on Iowa in the Civil War. It's called Nothing But Victory. And you can find a link to that series on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Coming up in just a moment, I'm going to talk with Lester Menke about his memories of growing up in Iowa in the 1920s and 30s. He's the author of a new book called When Apples Had No Worms. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Lester Menke has been many things in his long life, a farmer, a teacher. He served on the State Board of Education and as a state representative for 12 years from the 7th District. He spent 2 years as a liaison between Governor Terry Branstad and the legislature. Right now, mostly, he's a man who wants to share the stories of his life with his children, his grandchildren, and his great-grandchildren who live in a very different world than the one he grew up in. He's written his memoirs. When Apples Had No Worms is the name of a book. Hello, Lester.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure for me to be here.
And you were born in 1918. Where were you born?
I was born in out in the farm in a house near Geza, Iowa. Now, Geza is in O'Brien County. And when I think of Geza, we normally think of the Gaza Strip. But that's the name of a little town, and I think it's still in existence. But it's a very, very small place.
Your parents were farmers, but you didn't spend a lot of time on the farm as a child.
No, I did not. I was on the farm until I was about almost 5 years old, and then we moved into the town of Calumet, which is a small town also in O'Brien County, about 14 miles straight north of Cherokee on Highway 59.
Why did your parents leave the farm?
Well, they at that time retired. My dad was about 37 years old. Can you imagine retiring at that time? At that time, they didn't have the income tax that we have today. And as a result, the money that they did make, it did them well, you know. They didn't have to have a big accumulated amount of money. And so he just took the money that he had and invested it with other people in the community, kind of like running a bank of his own.
When they decided to leave the farm, you had a wonderful opportunity to take a very long family vacation out to California.
Yes, that was true.
When you went to Long Beach, California, tell me a little bit about what you saw when you were there.
Oh, it was marvelous. Of course, as a young kid, we took the train out there, and we got on the train at Cherokee and took it from there. And then as we stopped in Kansas City, my dad decided that I needed something to play with on the train, so he bought me a little iron Model T Ford, and I drove that on my hands and knees on the train all the way to California. But that is really what the primary thing that I had to play with all the time I was there. But I spent a lot of time at the beach, and of course went to the Busch Gardens and we went to the
The Rose Bowl Parade?
Rose Bowl Parade. We didn't go to the football game, but we went to the parade, and it was while I was at the parade that I had a horrible experience, because when the parade was over, everybody wanted to leave, and you just got squeezed in, and as a little boy, 5 years old, you can imagine where I was squeezed in, and people were pushing back and forth, and I was just about smothering, so I just took my finger and thumb and pinched the lady in her bottom. And as a result of that, she whirled around and was ready to beat my head in, and there was my mother like an old hen protecting her young chick, and she was not about to let me get beat up, but she knew I had done wrong. But it was necessary. I had to do it in order to survive.
And then she forgave you for that later.
Oh, well, of course she did. She was a disciplinarian. My dad didn't do much of disciplining, but she took care of me in that regard by using a little, she had just a little whip. And back in those days, none of us ever wore anything but knickers. And we didn't have long pants, so they'd whip you on the legs. And as a result, I think I learned to dance at an early age.
Something that served you well for many, many years. When you got back to Calumet, I can only guess that it was very rare for anyone to have traveled like that, to have spent so much time somewhere else in the country. When you were growing up, did you talk to other kids about that time in California?
No, not really. We didn't talk about things like that. I was an only child, and I was just extremely happy to be able to have some children in Calumet that I could play with. Most of the places that I had been, I was primarily alone. And so really all my life, I had a desire to have a family. I was very envious of all the other boys and girls that had sisters and brothers. And so I enjoyed just playing with kids and not telling them about any experiences I might have had in California.
Your mother came from a very large family. Did you have a lot of cousins to play with?
Oh, well, I had a huge amount of cousins. I had, I think, about 42 cousins. And we did get together and play together some. But primarily I played with the kids in the town of Calumet. Back in those days, everybody seemed to have children because there were younger people in those towns. Today those towns are made up of older people and there are fewer children. As a result, of course, that's why we do not have a school any longer in Calumet, because there just were not enough people to maintain a school there.
Having been born in 1918, you really came of age during the Great Depression, and you don't write a great deal about the privations of the Great Depression. How was your family affected?
Well, my family wasn't affected any more than anybody else. A matter of fact, I was perhaps more fortunate than some with the larger families. But back in those days, everybody was very, very conservative, had large gardens, and did everything that they possibly could to take care of having food. And so they did their own canning, and they would butcher hogs and have some beef and eggs. That was another item that was a good popular item. And as a result, I was in no worse shape than anybody else. They were all what you would say in the same boat at that time.
You graduated from high school and you went off to college in Sioux City.
Yes, went over to Morningside College. And that was a great experience for me. I enjoyed it very much. I took a pre-law course because I had done some studying with law at Primgar with R.J. Locke. He had a He was a good friend of my grandfather, and so I would go up there and study law with him while I was in high school. So then when I went to Morningside, I took pre-law and also picked up my teaching certificate, thinking that someday I may be on a school board and I'd like to know more about the teaching area.
So you were thinking way ahead at that point.
Well, yes, I really truly was, because I had observed that many of these people back in those days that were on school boards were selected not by their knowledge of schools, but did they own property in the area. It seemed like that was the prerequisite for wanting to be on a school board, so that you'd keep the expenses down. If you didn't own property, you had no business being on the school board back in those days. And I wanted to change that, which I did.
And you write about your dad being not a political man at all, someone who didn't want to engage in political discussions. But clearly you got bit by a political bug pretty early.
Yes, I did. And I tell you, I had a great deal of admiration for Lester Airey. He was a Democrat, a senator for the state of Iowa. And Guy Gillette was a man that was wanting to be purged by President Roosevelt, because Roosevelt didn't like some of the things that he voted for. But I thought he was a true statesman. He wasn't a politician. And I tried to emulate his philosophy while I was in the legislature here in Iowa. I thought I really wanted to do what was good for the state rather than what was good for politics.
When you graduated from Morningside, you went to college, went to law school at the University of Iowa for a short time, but you decided to go back to the farm, and you also got married during this time. What drew you back to the farm?
Yes, and that was a great decision, because my goal in life was to have a family. And I recognized that if I was going to practice law, I was going to have to wait a long time before I'd have enough money to raise a family. And my wife was from Manson, Iowa. Kathleen Culp was her name. And we married and went out on the farm back in 1941. And I just have never regretted it. I farmed out there for 31 years, and she was a wonderful mate. And we just enjoyed living out there and raising a family. We had 6 children. 1 child we lost, but we still have the 5 wonderful children. And to me, the only one thing in life that I really, truly like, and that's a family.
Your decision to go back to the farm changed your life in another big way as well, because you didn't go off to fight in World War II because of it.
That's true, but I was eligible, and there was a time when I come very near being taken in, and I went up and asked the people to tell me how soon it would be, and I was prepared to go any time that they asked me to go. And but it just happened at that time that they were wanting me to stay on the farm and continue making food for the rest of the world. And that's what we did. And after the war was over, the boys came back to me and said, would you run a school for us? And they wanted me to have on the job training school in regard to farming. And so I did. I operated had a school for the boys, and they could make $125 a month by attending that school. And at the very time that we were going to start it, I thought, oh, this will be most difficult. Now, I had been doing some teaching, but the teaching that I'd been doing was with boys and girls of a grade and high school age. But here now I was going to be working with men that were, some of them, perhaps even older than I was. And I had some qualms about it, thinking, oh my, this may be difficult. Well, it was quite the opposite. As it turned out, these boys had been into the service, and they were accustomed to taking orders, and they looked upon me as a teacher as almost being one of the boys in the service, telling them what to do. And we got along marvelously well, and it was a great experience for me.
In your book, When Apples Had No Worms, you focus on personal memories, not on your time in the state legislature. What was the purpose of setting down these stories?
Why did I call it that?
Well, not why did you call it that, but why did you write these stories down?
Oh, I wrote these stories down because I thought there should be something that my family would have in their hands to know what took place. In my lifetime, my dad's lifetime, and my grandparents' lifetime. And I gathered as much of it as I could, and I wrote over a period of years, just wrote in longhand. And that's why it was necessary for me, in order to complete this book, is to get somebody that is, I appreciated getting knowledge of, and that was Sherry Borzog, and she was the one that came and put the book together for me. Had she not done that, I probably wouldn't have ever gotten the book completed. But I had written much of it, and she helped me get the actual book put together. And I would suggest this to any young people, and I do suggest this to my children and grandchildren, write things down. I didn't do that during the years. I should have had a diary putting down each day what was taking place. At the time, you think, oh, I'll remember this. But if you don't write it down, as time goes on, you do forget some of the intricate details. And so that is my wish for all my young people that are thinking someday that they might want to write a book. Get the information down on paper now so it's more readily available for you to put the book together.
And where does the title come from, When Apples Had No Worms?
Well, the title comes from the fact that I could remember back when I was a four-year-old that you didn't have to worry about going out to the orchard, grabbing an apple, and finding that you only had half of the worm. It turned out that there were no worms in the apples at that time, because the apple trees were all new orchards, and you didn't have the problem of having worms. As time went on, and the apples dropped on the ground and laid there and rotted, then finally we got to the point where we were having worms, and it was necessary for somebody to come along and produce something to spray the trees so we no longer have the worms. But at that time, we didn't have a worry about worms.
Lester Menke, thank you so much for sharing your memories with us today.
Well, it's been my pleasure to talk to you.
And what a treasure you've given to your family. Lester Menke is the author of When Apples Had No Worms, his memoir. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Our production assistant today is Allison Sullivan, with technical support from Rick Fredrickson in Des Moines. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we begin our summer series about Iowa's cities and towns. We're going to start with rivalries. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.